This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Governor Eric Holcomb recently signed Senate Enrolled Act 389, a controversial wetlands bill that over 100 organizations across the state were hoping he would veto, but he didn't. Why is this bill controversial, and what is it all about? With us now is Rebecca Thiel, environment and energy reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca, I want to start with learning a little bit about this bill. You've been covering this topic extensively. Can you give us some background on the bill and more about what it means? It's very wordy and complex.
Right. So the simple part is what the law is supposed to do. The Indiana Wetlands Law is supposed to protect wetlands that the federal government doesn't protect. Now, the Trump administration made some changes to the Waters of the United States rule. And because of that change, now the majority of wetlands in the state actually fall under state protection. So that's the simple part. Mm-hmm. The more complicated part is what this final bill actually does. So there are three what we call classes of wetlands in the state. So you have your class three wetlands, and that's what you would usually think of when you think of a wetland. You know, mm-hmm. lots of water, lots of rare wildlife, that kind of thing. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have your class ones. And those might not be what you would think of when you think of a wetland. It might be kind of a low wet spot in a field or a stand of trees. And, you know, they have a lot of the same functions of those class threes, but to kind of a lesser extent. And then mm-hmm. there are class twos, and that's basically everything in between. So what this bill actually does is gets rid of all state protections for class one wetlands and some protections for class twos. And it's important to point out that those smaller class one wetlands and those class two, the kind of everything in between wetlands, those two classes make up the majority of wetlands in the state.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And mm-hmm. so I guess I'm just curious, you know, what is the backstory of all of this? Has this been a fight long in the making?
So, you know, I can't claim to know the entire backstory of this, but what I do know is that there's been some disputes between farmers and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Mm-hmm. IDEM will come in to, you know, farm field, and, you know, farmers and IDEM might battle over whether or not a spot on their property actually is a wetland. And if it is a wetland, you know, that farmer may have to do conservation practices, something to make sure that that wetland is protected. And of course, that costs money. So mm-hmm. I think that a lot of lawmakers that, you know, were in favor of this bill were trying to kind of err on the side of farmers in that way. But there are also some lawmakers that say maybe this bill went a little bit too far if this really is about just that issue between farmers and some IDEM employees.
Right. And so who sponsored this bill?
So the author was Senator Chris Garton, I believe. And he and then a couple of other lawmakers had a lot of connections to the home building and home development industry. And, you know, they're not exactly a fan of these smaller class one wetlands either, because if they want to build over top of them, they have to pay what's called mitigation fees. Mm-hmm. So these are basically fees that are supposed to mitigate the harms that they're doing to the environment. So, you know, ultimately, it could be creating something like a wetland in another part of the state. But of course, again, that's expensive. That's more red tape for home builders. And they said that, you know, the Indiana Home Builders Association said that that is driving up home prices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it sounds like the home builders actually are benefiting from this bill in the long run. What was the main pushback, though, when it came to this bill?
So number one, of course, is that wetlands are important. You know, we hear a lot about the wildlife habitat that they create that's really unique and rare. But I think that what's possibly even more important to talk about right now is the water quality impacts of removing some of these wetlands and the water quantity. There was just a Central Indiana study looking at water in Indianapolis and the donut counties. And it said that in the future, we could be looking at less water in that area because that growth is just expanding. And these wetlands help replenish the state's aquifers. So, that's probably not something that we're going to want to be messing with right now. Of course, there's also the issue of climate change and flooding and how much these wetlands prevent that flooding. And of course, the other thing that I kind of already mentioned is, does this bill actually fix the problem at hand? Is it fixing those disputes between IDEM employees and farmers? Is it fixing the issues that home builders have in paying these mitigation fees?
Right, and I guess that remains to be seen when this goes into effect. We do have a clip from State Senator Sue Glick. Who's she addressing in this clip?
So I believe that she is addressing just a host of senators and House lawmakers when the bill was in what they call concurrence, which is kind of where they're coming to an agreement, these two houses.
All right, let's take a listen.
There are problems with some of the wetland regulations. We do have people in state government that are somewhat over-regulated, overzealous. So rein them in. Talk about the problems that they have. This is more than throwing the baby out with the bathwater. This is throwing the bathwater, the storm water, the lake water, and the whole water system out.
So, Rebecca, were people surprised that this bill ended up getting signed by the governor, or was it pretty much a done deal?
Some people were surprised that Holcomb signed the bill. He had originally, when the bill was going to take out the entire Indiana wetlands law, all protections, he did speak out against the bill and even said, "Hey, IDEM, DNR, you can go ahead and testify against that bill. You can feel free to do that." So there was a little bit of a question there as to whether or not he would veto this. But, much like at the federal level, things tend to run along party lines here in Indiana. So, personally, I'm not as surprised that he did eventually end up signing the bill after those changes were made to make it a little bit more specific to some of the wetlands that we were talking about.
Right. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. You mentioned that there were some rumblings that maybe this part of this bill was disputes between farmers and IDM. Would you say that most farmers support this bill?
It's hard to say just how many farmers support the bill. Obviously, the farmers that have gotten into disputes with IDEM do. And of course, the Farm Bureau was in support of the bill. But I did hear from at least one farmer, Rodney Rulin, who does a lot of conservation practices on his land and is very concerned about water quality, that he was against the bill. Something that I thought it was interesting that he said was, "No farmer wants to deal with multiple agencies, fees, paperwork, but it's important that we protect these water resources." I think in that sentiment right there, you can see that there's probably a range of opinions about this bill. I think one thing that I forgot to mention that I think is important, there was also some question about whether or not farmland was ever subject to these wetland regulations. I had heard from several lawmakers that agricultural land was supposed to be exempt. So it's, that's still up in the air about, what are these different disputes and what kinds of action we're going to see between farmers and IDEM now.
Well, now that the governor has signed this bill, what is the next step for people who are still upset about it getting passed and are trying to maybe reverse it or find some kind of a resolution to the situation? What would they be doing now? What's the next step?
So one part of the bill that I forgot to mention, because as you said, it's a complicated bill, Is that it also creates a task force to study the wetlands law and some of the issues that prompted the bill. Now, several lawmakers have asked, why is it that we aren't letting this task force go ahead and do its work before changing the law and instead sort of running it concurrently? But, you know, that's to get to your
That would make too much sense.
Right. But to get to your question, of course, you know, I've talked with activists from the Nature Conservancy and the Hoosier Environmental Council, and it seems like they're really going to try to be as involved with this task force as they can, in the hope that that task force will look at the science and reach some conclusions about and try to change this law so that it better protects the state's wetlands.
Okay, so they're still trying to be involved, at least with this iteration of the bill and the task force. But did anybody mention in trying to introduce some, I don't know, a counter bill to take this one down?
At the moment, not so much. I think that they're really going to try to see how they can get the best folks on this task force and then make the best decision through that task force.
As we get ready to close here, how does Indiana compare to other states in this area when it comes to shutting down environmental efforts? Are we better off or worse?
So, of course, that's always a hard comparison. On the one hand, there are some states that don't have these state protections for wetlands, so that's one thing. But what I do think causes a lot of harm in Indiana is what we call the no more stringent than law, basically saying that in Indiana, we're not allowed to make environmental rules that are stricter than federal ones. And that's important because when these federal environmental rules are made, they're really supposed to be the bare minimum. They're supposed to be the floor. And so by Indiana taking this sort of approach to environmental rules and saying we're going to let the bare minimum be the cap for us, I think that that has really done some harm, some environmental harm in the state that perhaps in other states we aren't really seeing because they have stricter, more tailored laws to what's really happening in their state with their environment.
Thank you for joining us. Rebecca Thiel, environment and energy reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Up next, climate change is real, but why is it so hard for us to accept and take action? We'll speak with an expert who can give us insight into what's happening and offer us some tips on how we can make changes. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We know now that it's a fact. Climate change is real, but it's hard to think about it because as it happens around us slowly over the years, we don't often realize the harsh effects of what is happening to our planet. Maybe when we see a photo of a giant floating garbage island in the middle of the ocean and see the dying coral reefs, it will sink in. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. When we live in comfort and privilege, all that seems so far away from our reality. With us today to talk more about climate change, its impact, and more is Lingxi Chenyang, environmental law fellow at the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. Welcome, Lingxi.
Hi, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with just the basics. What is climate change and why do we still hear it being touted as something controversial when it's a fact?
So climate change is this phenomenon caused by humans producing heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And what happens is that those gases cause global temperatures to rise, which influences rainfall patterns around the globe. I'm not sure why it's still touted as something that's not true. I imagine that, you know, there are a lot of economic forces that are in the interest of pretending that climate change is not real. But I think we are seeing all that shifting, which is really fortunate for us.
Right. And when you say that it's shifting, have you noticed that it's just something that's more commonly talked about?
Yeah, I think it's more commonly talked about. I also think that due to advocacy from a lot of young people in the past couple of years, it's, you know, been in the news more. And it's just on top of our minds more.
And when it comes to climate change closer to home, let's say here in Indiana, are we seeing an impact? Is this something that we might see in our lifetime, some dramatic effects?
Yeah, we've already started seeing lots of the effects of climate change. So in Indiana, the state has already warmed about 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895, and temperatures are projected to increase up to 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit by 2050. And I think what that means on a yearly basis that we'll see more extremely hot days. So for instance, in southern Indiana, they've averaged about 7 extremely hot days in a year. But by 2050, that region is projected to experience up to 51 extremely hot days. There are also going to be fewer extremely cold days. And so, you know, for most of us, that means higher AC costs in the spring and summer. And in terms of health impacts, you know, climate change is going to impact those of us who are most vulnerable. So there are going to be more heat strokes, especially in urban areas, which will affect the children and elderly. Hotter weather means that there's going to be an increased growing season for plants, which extends the allergy season. And a longer season for mosquitoes and disease-carrying insects is caused by, you know, a shorter cold season. Mm-hmm. So all of those will be health impacts.
Yeah, I'm just thinking allergy season being extended is something I definitely do not want to see as an allergy sufferer. And then with mosquitoes and all of these things, I realize those are things that I never really took into account when thinking about climate change, just sort of the broad-ranging repercussions.
Yeah, I mean, we're not the only species that will be affected by, you know, hotter weather and changing precipitation patterns. And, you know, we're connected to insects and animals, so it'll affect everything.
Mm-hmm. And now you do a lot of research with agriculture. Can you tell us about that and how climate change factors into it?
Sure. So agriculture is an especially, I think, important thing in Indiana because about 60% of our land is in farmland. And so hotter weather is going to stress those key commodity crops that we rely on, like corn and soybeans. But climate change will also bring more rain and heavier rain, which means that there's a higher risk of flooding, which means delayed times for planting and crop damage. So for instance, in 2008, the floods that year killed about 24 people and caused about $8 billion in agricultural losses in Indiana alone. So our farmers are going to be suffering as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, for Indiana, agriculture is such a huge part of the state. Is there anything in terms of what agriculture is doing to harm the environment? And I only bring this up because we do have this text group that we call the Indiana Two-Way through Indiana Public Broadcasting, where listeners are asked questions. And there was a person who responded saying about climate change that there's too much focus on agriculture and farming here in the state and not enough focus on the impact it has on the environment.
Yeah, so there are a lot of, I think, practices that could be shifted to help with climate change. So, you know, one practice that is harmful is monoculture crop production. So growing the same kind of crop on a large field, because in order for that system to work, you have to put in a lot of inputs. And a lot of those inputs kind of leak into the atmosphere because they're not being used by a system that's just the same throughout. And that includes fertilizers, which off-gas into the atmosphere as nitrogen, which is a harmful greenhouse gas on cornfields and soybean fields. And, you know, monoculture crop fields also require a lot of pesticides, which doesn't directly influence climate change, but, you know, affects our biodiversity. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, you know, agriculture can also play a big part in the solutions for climate change. So for instance, Indiana introduced a carbon market bill this past term. It survived the Senate, thankfully, and it made it to the House, but now it's in limbo. Basically what it does is it establishes a carbon market registration program that allows farmers to sequester carbon on their farmland by planting fruit and nut trees and cover crops, and then allow those credits to be traded with, you know, for instance, major corporations like Amazon and Microsoft that have pledged to reduce its carbon emissions by basically undertaking other actions like buying these offset credits to reduce their overall emissions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that bill eventually becomes law, it could help farmers help climate change, and especially could help our small farmers thrive because they're getting this additional revenue from the carbon offset credits.
Mm-hmm. And does Indiana compare to any other states doing similar stuff like this, or is it leading in this area?
Yeah, so it would be one of the leaders. So California has done this. States on the East Coast have also done this carbon market trading scheme, and they've involved farmers in that system. And so it's been, you know, proven to work basically on the coasts. And in Indiana, we have so many farmers, so it could make a really big difference here.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to talking about farming, there's also the aspect of animals and perhaps their impact on the environment. Is that anything that we're seeing in Indiana, or are there ways to maybe improve some of the practices there?
Yeah, so the animal agriculture industry is a big contributor to climate change, but there are ways that that farmers can help. So one thing is to install methane digesters on, for instance, dairy farms. And, you know, in California, offset credits could be awarded to dairy farmers who install these digesters. Basically, they use manure from cows and burn the methane as energy. So that's one way. Another way to kind of reduce the carbon emissions from animal agriculture is by incorporating animals and plants on the same operation. So in that way, sort of the animal, you know, manure from cows, they get used to provide fertilizer and nutrients for crops, and the crops, some of the crops get to, can be used to as feedstock for the animals. So there's kind of a closed loop system. So, you know, I think if we see this kind of incorporation of both animals and crops on farms, it could really help reduce emissions from monoculture mm-hmm. operations.
Are we on a good trajectory when it comes to environmental practices, either in Indiana or nationally, or are things getting worse?
There have been a lot of actions at the federal level to encourage farmers to adopt these practices. I think in Indiana, we could do a lot more, and particularly because, you know, our state is so reliant on agriculture. But I think we're seeing a shift at the federal level, and hopefully that kind of percolates to the state level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about wetlands in light of a bill that the governor recently signed. First, can you tell us what are wetlands for folks who may not understand the sort of intricacies of what defines a wetland?
Yeah, wetlands are just land submerged in water. Usually there's a lot of vegetation and animals living there. Indiana used to be covered with wetlands, and only about 15% of its original wetlands remain, mostly due to farming and development. And so 80% of those remaining wetlands are protected under state law, and about 20% is protected under federal law.
Mm-hmm. And how are these wetlands beneficial? I just want to play sort of devil's advocate here to folks that might say, well, there's you said 80% or so wetlands that are being protected right now locally. Well, what if we had 50% and the rest we can get rid of?
Yeah, so wetlands play a really important environmental role on three counts. So they're really important for cleaning our drinking water. So wetlands are connected to groundwater stores, and basically its plants help filter pollutants that flow from surface water through rainfall into the groundwater. So they kind of function as kidneys for our water system. Mm-hmm. And this function is really important with climate change because we'll be seeing heavier rains, which means that there's going to be more fertilizers and heavy metals flowing into our drinking water sources. Wetlands are also important for climate change because they sequester a ton of carbon. So they're very carbon dense. Carbon is stored in both the plants and the soil of wetlands. Scientists estimate that wetlands store about 7 times more carbon per acre compared with farmland. And so when you drain a wetland, those plants in the wetland decompose and release carbon very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And wetlands are also really important for biodiversity. So wetlands serve as important breeding grounds for many bird, insect, and animal species. So, you know, cutting our wetlands by half would impact three of those really critical functions, which, you know, with climate change being such a time sensitive thing, we just can't really afford.
You know, I think it's really interesting, the comparison you made to that the wetlands are like our kidneys to sort of filter out contaminants in water. I've never thought of it like that. And I think it's really helpful to kind of visualize that. We did have another comment raised via the Indiana Two-Way, and it was the concern over the governor's signing of a bill surrounding wetlands. The comment said, in part, Indiana should have been a leader in protecting our natural resource water and decreasing the effects of flooding by seeing that wetlands were preserved. What are your thoughts on this bill?
Yeah, so this bill, SB 389, was signed into law last Thursday. As you said, it'll impact that 80% of wetlands protected under state law. And so the way that works is that previously you had to get a permit to develop or farm on smaller isolated wetlands or create new wetlands to make up for that development. And the law basically gets rid of those requirements. And so, you know, I think this law is not great on those three counts, right? It's not great for clean drinking water. It's not great for climate change. And it's not great for biodiversity. These are all things that wetlands help with.
Right. And we spoke earlier in our program with a reporter who's been covering the wetlands bill. How important are these to the state of Indiana? I know we've mentioned, you know, a couple times here just about their function and everything. But for folks who aren't convinced that it matters, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, a good way to think about it is, you know, what else are we going to do to maintain those critical functions that wetlands already play, right? We have to have clean drinking water. And so we have to spend money on something else that cleans your drinking water. You know, if we don't sequester carbon right now, then we're going to have to deal with hotter weather and increased rainfall in some other way, right? So the question is, are we spending our efforts and money now to protect what we already have, or are we going to spend it later? And so I think that's kind of the strongest argument for protecting what we already have.
Right. I'm just imagining like trying to fix things later rather than having them kind of fixed from now.
Right.
Well, how detrimental would this bill or things like this be in the long run? Is it going to, you know, cost us a lot?
So I don't know the precise cost projections that this bill would, you know, lead 50 down, years down the road.
Right.
But yeah, I think it will cost us. And it's bad when our future generations have to pay that cost and figure out what they are.
Now, often when we talk about climate change, it can feel like it's surrounded in language of crisis and panic and hopelessness to some degree. Are there things that we can do to change what's happening?
Yeah, so I want to mention a couple of things. So, you know, that bill was, I think, not great for climate change, but the carbon market bill that was introduced recently is. And so there has been some political action on climate. And, you know, even though I think our state government has not really done enough compared with our neighbors, like in Illinois, Michigan, and Kentucky, which have all sort of released statewide climate recommendations or plans in the last 15 years, cities, communities, and schools in Indiana have really picked up the slack. So at IU Bloomington, where I work for the Environmental Resilience Institute, which basically helps local governments come up with climate action plans to deal with hotter and wetter weather, to reduce their carbon footprint. And 15 cities in Indiana, including, you know, where I live in Indianapolis, have some kind of plan in place. And, you know, religious congregations have gotten involved too. So more than 50 churches around the state have installed rooftop solar panels. Ball State University in Muncie, where many of my friends in Indiana went for school, recently replaced its coal-fired boilers with a geothermal system. So that cut the campus carbon footprint in half and produced a ton of jobs and saved a lot of water and a lot of costs. So what can you do? So you can push for your local government, if they haven't done so, to adopt a climate action plan, and ERI has the tools to help. I'm particularly proud of our children, teenagers, who have been very active in showing up to town halls and pushing for, you know, the adults to write climate resolutions and climate action plans. And, you know, having your kids and teenagers get involved means that they might be the leaders and policymakers of tomorrow. And I think on an individual level, you can sort of set an example by reducing your own carbon footprint. Some of the most impactful things that you can do is fly a little bit less, eat more of a plant-based diet, bike more, think about making your next car electric. You know, in addition to reducing your own carbon footprint, these actions are important ways to convey that, you know, things are changing, even if we can't always see it. You know, I've adopted a plant-based diet in the last 10 years, and it, whenever I mention it, it sparks a lot of interesting conversations about my work and about climate change. So I think all of those things are helpful.
Right, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Lingxi Chenyang, Environmental Law Fellow, Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. Just ahead, are more people moving in or out of Indiana? And how has the housing market been doing amidst the pandemic? All that and more coming up. If you have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Every year, there are numbers touted to indicate whether the state is growing in its population or whether people are fleeing the state for other opportunities. A recent article in the South Bend Tribune mentioned that while the state's population grew, it wasn't enough to gain a congressional seat. Is that cause for concern? And how has the housing market taken a hit when it comes to population growth or loss? And yes, all of this amidst a pandemic. With us to uncover the answers to these questions and more is Matthew Kinghorn, Senior Demographic Analyst, Indiana Business Research Center at the Indiana University Kelley School of Business. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to join you.
Matthew, let's start first with the population in Indiana. According to the census data, we saw some growth, but how accurate is this data?
Well, it should be very accurate, we hope. So this is this is as close as we can get to an actual headcount of the state's population or of the nation's population. So rather than being a survey or an estimate, you know, based off of sampling or something, this is, you know, as everybody knows, they received their survey in the mail. If they didn't answer it, then they got people coming to the door to try to take down this information. So it's constitutionally mandated that it be carried out that way. And it has been since 1790. So this is about as good as it gets.
And when you say it's about as good as it gets, I wonder, you know, the folks that kind of fall through the cracks and don't fill it out, does that have any impact in the long run?
Well, it can. I mean, there are there's no such thing as a perfect census. And it can be, you know, certain areas, certain populations can be a little bit more difficult to count than others. And so I know that the Census Bureau does all they can to, pours a lot of resources into making sure they count as many people as possible. But there are always some places where there can be an undercount. And, usually within a year or so after the census, we have some analysis of kind of what the magnitude of that undercount may be. Mm-hmm. But so we'll have to wait and see on that.
So would you say overall the census is a good metric to measure populations, or is there a better tool?
No, I think it's the best we can do. I mean, you know, I think that, some use of, say, administrative records so can be helpful, but there's always people who fall through the cracks on that sort of kind of estimation process. So this is, I think, the best we can do.
Well, for the opening, I mentioned that the state's population grew. How accurate is that in the sense that it says we didn't gain a congressional seat?
Yeah, we should, rather than not gaining a congressional seat, we should be happy that we didn't lose one. So, each of our, if we look at our neighbors, Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan, were three of the seven states that had lost a congressional seat. It seems unlikely, it would be, it's hard to imagine what would have to happen for Indiana to actually begin to pick up a congressional seat. You know, we started with 13 congressional seats and we're down to nine now. So we've lost some, you know, over the last, you know, four seats over the last century or so. And that's just, you know, reflects really the decades long movement of people from the Northeast and the Midwest to the South and the West. And so that's been going on a long time. And so we see political representation going that way as well.
Mm-hmm. So really, those are just sounding like headline grabbing statements rather than focusing on the actual facts. What does it mean when there is population growth, and what are important things to consider about it?
Well, it's good. It's good that we had population growth. And so, you know, but we normally do. I mean, we always do, really. So the population is always growing. That doesn't mean there's always more people moving to the state than moving away. But usually the biggest source of population growth is what's called natural increase, or the difference between the number of births and the number of deaths. And so, you know, we had, again, that was the case again, where natural increase contributed most to our population growth. But it's also the natural increase is declining as our population ages. And so that's why, you know, we grew by 4.7% over the last decade. You know, that compares to almost 7% during the 2000s, almost 10% during the 1990s. So our growth is slowing. Some of that is to lower migration to the state, but a lot of it is to a lot less natural increase. And so that's something that we will continue to see as the population ages. And really another dramatic trend we've seen is a real decline in birth rates. So especially, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years, it's been a real stark drop in birth rates.
Can you have population growth while simultaneously losing people to other states, you know, moving away?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so the natural increase is the main driver of population growth. And so we have had, you know, several periods where we've had more people moving away, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s. We had a pretty strong net out migration from the state, but the state continued to grow just because of that natural increase.
Mm-hmm. And what about Indiana? Where does the state stand overall when it comes to population growth versus loss?
Well, I mean, we, you know, like I said, we've about 4.7% population growth over the last 10 years. So that is, you know, ranks, I think, 29th nationally, out of the 50 states. So again, most of the fast-growing states are in the South and in the West. Our pace of growth in the last 10 years outpaced all of our neighbors. You know, we grew faster than Kentucky and Illinois, Ohio and Michigan. So we're doing okay for our neighborhood, but we're still, you know, far behind. You know, we're seeing states, you know, I think Utah led the way this past decade with 18% growth. You know, a lot of states growing by more than 10%. And so we were at 4.7.
Mm-hmm. And just so I'm understanding correctly, the growth has been more of a natural growth. Is there anything factoring in folks that are moving in droves, let's say, to a certain state because of incentives that are being offered?
Well, I mean, we still had a net in migration this past decade. So we had more people moving to Indiana than moving away. And so, you know, I don't know how much, you know, the financial incentives are influencing people, but there's, you know, it's pretty steady, you know, the flow to the South and the West. So it seem to have been the magnets for people moving for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Is there an indication of why people would choose to leave Indiana if they, you know, if they wanted to get better opportunities? Is there a certain specific, I don't know, like incentives or tax breaks or things that give people that reason to leave?
Well, it usually wouldn't be a financial decision in the sense of a cost of living. Mm-hmm. Indiana would be a pretty low cost of living state, but you know, there's more, you know, more diverse, maybe employment opportunities in other parts of the country, you know, more areas of the country with more dynamic, you know, economies. And so that could be a draw for a lot of people, especially those with, you know, a college education or so. So that could be a big draw for people moving, you know, and then there's also, you know, just kind of the usual things of people preferring if they have a choice of maybe warmer climates or things of that nature. So I think that would be the biggest drivers.
Do you think there's going to be any changes, speaking of weather, you know, when these climate change effects take more prevalence, in the coming, I don't know, decades, hopefully in the centuries that we don't have to witness too much. But would that drive any movement at all?
Well, I mean, you know, if you know, I could see if people were forced to, if, say, coastal areas were becoming more uninhabitable. But, you know, it's hard to say that would drive a lot of, say, people move to the Midwest or to Indiana. You know, but I could see other factors such as just cost of living would be a big one that could drive people from kind of the more fast-growing metropolitan areas to a place like Indiana, especially if kind of this shift with, you know, remote working and whatnot were to take hold. Then that certainly, you know, opens up the playfield for a lot of other states.
Right. And how has the pandemic impacted any of this stuff in terms of people's movement, population?
Well, you know, it wouldn't really be reflected in these numbers, the census numbers that were released, because this was, you know, they were doing this count. I mean, the pandemic threw a wrench into the actual execution of the census, because it was right about when they were going into the field to do the kind of door-to-door counting. But kind of some of the effects that it may have on fertility rates or on migration or whatnot would come after these numbers. Mm-hmm. But I would certainly expect to see that, you know, that we had seen less people moving around, at least, you know, during the height of the pandemic, just because of all the economic uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I would expect that we would see lower fertility rates. You know, the CDC just released a report today with provisional birth data, and Indiana had its lowest birth total, really, I think, going back to the World War II. So, so it's, you know, we've seen decline in births, but it was a pretty pretty stark number that we saw for 2020, and I would expect even lower numbers for 2021.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
The deaths would be higher because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the population in Indiana. We're also going to talk about the housing market with Matthew Kinghorn, Senior Demographic Analyst, Indiana Business Research Center at the Indiana University Kelly School of Business. Before we get into the housing market, I'm curious, you know, when it comes to Indiana, do you think that there are enough sort of incentives or things that would drive people to want to do business here, to want to move to the state and open up their business?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly when it comes to cost of doing business and cost of living are certainly cards for Indiana. As far as incentives, you know, I'm not real up on whether or not our economic development incentives, how they compare to other states or not. But so I can't really comment there. But I know there are programs like, you know, we had a couple of years ago, the Regional Cities Initiative, which is, you know, really a drive to help communities improve quality of place. And I think that they're maybe looking at another round of that coming up in the next year or two. So I think that those are the kinds of efforts that can help improve Indiana's standing.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the housing market here in the state, has it been impacted by the pandemic?
Well, it has. I mean, I think that the housing market is really kind of out of whack right now. But I think that predates the pandemic. You know, I mean, it's, you know, Indiana, you know, when it comes to like existing home sales in 2020, it had a record number of existing home sales last year. And that's even with the pandemic. So I think so demand is incredibly strong. And, you know, at the same time, the inventory of homes on the market or the supply of housing is incredibly tight. Mm-hmm. And so that's really driving prices through the roof. And so it's a real, real strange market right now.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned the prices thing, because that's the stuff that I've been coming across is that, you know, prices are soaring. Somebody might have a house that's valued at a certain amount, but suddenly they get 10 times the amount because everybody's bidding on that because there's not enough housing to go around. Is that pretty accurate for Indiana?
Oh, it is. Yeah. I mean, Indiana is seeing, and again, this goes back 4 years or so, but kind of the rate of house price appreciation in Indiana right now, it's higher than the national average. And it's really higher than anything we've ever seen in the last three decades or so, at least, you know, for the data that we have. We've never had price growth like this in Indiana, you know, in any time in several decades. So right. It's a pretty dramatic market right now.
And you mentioned some of this has been happening before the pandemic. Is there any idea of what's been driving interest in homes in Indiana?
Well, it's a really a national trend. So this isn't just something that's happening in Indiana, but it seems to be, like I said, the price growth is fascinating right now. And that's just because the market is so tight. There's really very little construction, even though that's starting to change. The new housing permits so far in the first quarter of this year is a big improvement over what we've seen last year and previous years. But it's just, but in general, residential construction is very, very low. And so if you're looking for a home, it's been, the existing housing market is really the only game in town. And so it's, and so everything, anytime someone puts a house on the market, it's going, like hotcakes. And so, and like you say, with multiple bids and prices being driven up. And so it's a tough market for if you're wanting to buy.
Right. And I wonder, too, if the pandemic has influenced some folks to move to the Midwest. And so they're able to maybe on a higher salary from the East Coast come into Indiana and bid five times the price on something, if that's going to cause any sort of discrepancies.
Well, I mean, that could be. I don't have any information on that, but that's not, out of the question. And so, but who this really hurts, though, is the, the first time buyers. People really trying to crack into the market. But, when you see house prices going up 10-12% a year, it's very difficult for people who are, wanting to make that first purchase.
Right. And are there any trends you're expecting to see in the next few years with regards to the housing market, whether it continues to grow or prices continue to increase?
Well, it will. I mean, and unless we see a big spike in residential construction, and I've been thinking and saying for years that because of the tight supply and the surging prices that residential construction really has to pick up, and it hasn't yet. It's been a lot for quite a few years. We've been waiting for this. Like I said, we're seeing a little bit of an uptick so far this spring, and so let's hope that means that 2021 is going to be a big year for residential construction, because something's going to have to give, because we can't continue to see prices rise at this rate.
Right. Could Indiana become the next, Silicon Valley with housing problems?
Well, I don't know that'll be quite that dramatic. So we'll see what happens.
And then what about with trends in population? Are we going to see anything in the coming years? Is that something we're going to have to wait and see once the data comes out after things clear up with the pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think that it's pretty clear what we can expect. I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see, we have an aging population. So we're going to see that, that continue, by 2030, the youngest of the baby boomers will be over 65. So that's going to really transform the state. So we're getting older and older. We're also getting more diverse. So that will continue. Especially in younger population is more diverse than that, say that's the senior population. Mm-hmm. And we'll also see, the growth that we do have in the state increasingly has been, and I think will continue to be, concentrated in just, a handful of metropolitan areas. So, we've seen Indianapolis area and, Fort Wayne and, Columbus, Lafayette, Bloomington, et cetera, really drive all the growth. But then we have, large swaths of the state that are seeing population decline and seeing really rapidly aging population. And so I think that, those are really the trends to keep an eye on, over the next 10 years.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be paying attention. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Kinghorn is a senior demographic analyst at the Indiana Business Research Center at the Indiana University Kelley School of Business. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And join us Monday as we talk about sex and the pandemic. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.